AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another very special episode of the 1973 podcast. We're here with former NHL player Peter Tagliolinetti. And Tags, I just want to say thank you from the guys, and we're honored to have you on the show. And, you know, we're all local guys. We're Massachusetts guys, so we know that you're born in Massachusetts.
You can't tell by the accent or anything.
Yeah. I've had a few people chirp me on the show, and I'm all for it because we're all about the, the old school chirping. So we'll have at it. So we always ask to start the episodes off with take us back to hockey as a kid and how the journey got you. At least we'll go the start to the college ranks.
Yeah, so I was born in 1963, and everybody in Boston knows 1967 was a pretty big time when Bob Uecker shows up on the scene, right? So, you know, I'm 4 years old, and in our neighborhood, as I'm from Framingham, Massachusetts, during the day, like on a Saturday after a Sunday afternoon, I'm the only kid left in the neighborhood, and we're in the suburbs, but you know, there's all kinds of kids around, but I'm like the only one left around, and everybody else was playing hockey at the time, and my parents didn't know anything about hockey, my dad was 56 when he had me, so he was a working guy, whatever. My mom had no idea about sports, and she literally thought I was going to get in trouble being by myself. And honest to God, she actually somewhere along the line, she used to be a secretary for the guy who ran the hockey association in Framingham. And she made the call, and there was a waiting list to get in. And just by her knowing him, they got me in, and I started skating at the age of 5. So yeah, just to keep me off the street. And quite frankly, I was 5-6 years old. My mom took a life insurance policy out on me just in case I did something stupid. So that's what I grew up with.
So obviously, Bob, you're a huge influence as a kid.
Hockey, you guys, hockey's huge in Boston, right? And there was a couple things that really threw it over the top. One, Bob Uecker shows up, and everybody wants to play hockey now. And then they win the Stanley Cups. They do all those things. They really boom. And then right towards the end of the 70s, you know, the hockey started just tailing off a little bit. Bobby was hurt. He got traded away, and it was just kind of a lot, just like America, just like a laissez-faire type thing. And the 80 Olympics showed up and boomed it again. And you just had another renaissance of young kids playing hockey all of a sudden. And it goes through those cycles. And I got caught in the first one. And then the guys after me got caught in that second one.
Yeah, that's me. Definitely. I started in around 77. And I tell people that I work with that when I started, there was no cages. It was just the helmet. And then right after USA Hockey kind of got involved, that's when the cages came on.
I hate USA. I hate it. Don't get me started. It'd be a whole nother hour podcast on that. Those idiots.
Feel free. Because I have my issues too with USA Hockey over the years too. Take us through the high school and into, the Providence College years.
Yeah. So Framingham was a huge town. And we had four high schools in our town, the two public schools, North and South, Marion, which is a Catholic school, and Keefe Tech, which is a vocational school. So all through youth hockey, there was in our age group, there was probably like 20, 22 guys are always in there, type thing. And once we got into high school, a lot of kids, a couple of kids went to North, a bunch of kids went to Marion, and most of the kids were at South, and there was one or two kids at Keefe. So we got kind of separated at that juncture. It kind of sucks because we had really good teams growing up, and all of a sudden we got depleted a little bit because of that factor in it. And then, we just didn't have the, I mean, we had some really good teams, and we won the league. We won the Bay State League our senior year. But you know, it was just, we just didn't have that talent to get over to the Belmont Hills of the world or the Matinons of the world or anything like that. We just didn't have that type of caliber. If we had the rest of the team, we did. And then, I got a kid a year older than me. His name is Steven Giatrellis. He was started in Hockey Night in Boston when it really first started. You know, in the late 70s, you know, it was only four teams, North, South, East, West. And he talked to Darby Yeager and Lance LaFaro, I think his last name was, who started it. And they, he said, you got to bring him, try to get him onto one of these teams. And that's how I really started getting noticed. Because my junior year coming in high school, they got me into that Hockey Night in Boston. And then I kind of got noticed there from there. And coaches started taking interest, my senior year. And my rival was Richie Costello. And I don't know if you know, remember him out of Natick. And it was a lot of people coming to watch him play. But as we were playing each other, I got more and more noticed by that type thing. And I got Lou Lamorello from Providence asked me to, you know, gave me the opportunity to go. And I mean, I could have went to Boston College, BU, and the rest of them, but there were too big of a schools for me. I kind of knew my niche where I was going to be. And if I was in a school with, my class is 150 kids, I never would have went to class. You know, I probably would have failed, you know, whatever it is. And then go to Providence and, there was 20, 25 kids in each class. There was one class that was really big, but on Fridays they split them off. So they kept tabs on you all the time, made sure you were doing what you were supposed to do, and didn't fall through the cracks of college life. So and that's what happened. And Lamorello kind of took me for a couple of years, and he left, obviously. And then Steve Sterling came in, and I got drafted after my sophomore year. We went to the Final Four in North Dakota, and Winnipeg picked me up. I was 41st overall, the first person taken in the third round in the 83 draft, and didn't really care much about it. It was the summertime. Obviously I was working, my mom ended up calling the place I worked and said, "Hey, can you get a hold of Pete? They just got drafted and whatever." And they didn't really care much about it. It's not like it was nowadays. And and then I was very fortunate. After, as soon as I finished my senior year, Winnipeg signed me and turned pro. So it was actually kind of a whirlwind type thing, going from Final Four to turning pro.
So, Tags, I want to ask you, we always ask this question too, because there's been some good ones. Draft day stories. You kind of touched on it, but you were at work.
I was landscaping. I was doing landscaping. And it wasn't that big of a deal for me. Obviously if there is the internet was back then, it would probably be a lot more, whatever it was. And if you weren't drafted into the first round, nobody really gave two craps, one of those type things. And, I just did what I did. And I had no desire. I mean, I had no inclination that I was going to ever turn pro. It was a great honor being drafted and whatnot. But it never really dawned on me.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Till the day I actually, I was at school and they said, "Hey, we did Lamorello negotiating my contract." And he called me and said, "Yeah, your contract's all done. I'll drive you to the airport tomorrow morning." And I was off and met the Winnipeg Jets for the playoffs. So,
before we get into the NHL stuff, I want to have Tom and Ed ask some questions. So, Tom, yep. Question for Tex.
Was it a surprise that Winnipeg took you, or were you talking with any other teams?
No, nobody talked. I mean, you know, it's funny. These kids now talk to everybody. I mean, back then, nobody the teams didn't give two shits about you. They really didn't. I mean, you know, as long as they the scouts are looking and, you know, doing whatever, and they draft you and they call you, hey, you know, we're really happy. Oh, great, great, great. But, you know, nobody talked to you. Nobody had the idea, you know, until that Eric Lindros thing with I'm not going to Quebec type deal. No, nobody gave. You did what you were told. You get drafted at the end of it, you know. And now all of a sudden, oh, I don't want to go there. I don't want to play there. I don't want to play in a Canadian city. You know, it's so foolish. I mean, I don't blame the kids. I blame the parents, and I blame the agents who get involved way too early with these kids. It's So nobody called me. Nobody called me. Nobody talked. I mean, you knew that when you were playing that hockey night in Boston, you knew that there were scouts there watching. And by, you know, hearing something, hey, they're here watching, you know, a couple defensemen, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you're one of those D, you know, that's about it.
How did Lou negotiate that contract? Was it a good one, or did he get his house painted on the side, or?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, it's so strange now, like all these guys. Well, I shouldn't say all of them, but most of the guy now has got, you know, one way contracts, whether they're making a ton of money or they're making one way, you know, a couple $100,000 in the minors. Well, you know, he, John Ferguson. I don't remember John Ferguson for the old tough guy for the Montreal Canadiens. Yep. I mean, scary dude, absolute scary dude. But you know, Lou called, you know, got it all done. And, I got a 4-year deal. I was actually, so my minor league salary was probably one of the highest in the minors at the time. And then my, you know, my NHL salary was, you know, just above what everybody, a lot of guys were making. So, I mean, it was fine with me. But I think, he had a good relationship with John Ferguson and say, hey, listen, this, you know, I think he kind of said, listen, be hard on him. Do the, you know, give him the fucking business. Sorry, I swear.
That's give all right. Him the business. No, let him rip.
You know, and he'll respond type thing. And Fergie, you know, and honest to God, he was probably one of the best people I ever met in hockey. So yeah, I think Lou did a nice job with my contract then. And I got some minor league stories about that kind of money in the minors so I was up and down the first couple of years. So
we'll hold that right there. Ed, question for Tex.
What was your favorite story that you have, or favorite experience from college hockey that just, it really stands out to you that, you know, that was really just a great time or a great experience?
You know, it's funny. I was talking to a couple, another couple guys from Providence, and, you know, the one thing we did not have as a team was a lot of camaraderie. You know, like now a lot of, you talk to the guys from BC, they always get together. You know, the BU guys always together, they're always doing something together. Providence has never done anything like that. And I don't know if that was Lou's making, you know, like, hey, no, we're here to do this. We're not worried about the rest of the stuff. We had a lot of good times, a lot of fun times. I think the, you know, the college wise, it was, you know, we had two Final Fours, you know, that we went to. And I think that would be the only thing that really stands out. And I do have some good friends that I played with. I mean, we don't talk as much as you probably think we should talk. I think that we went to two Final Fours, which a lot of guys, you know, didn't have a chance to play in any of them. So I've been pretty lucky in getting to some of these things that I've been able to do.
Yeah. The Hockey East tags back through the 80s and the early 90s. It was like the be all end all of like a division in college hockey. Yeah. It was amazing. We used to go all the time to see games because it was cheap, it was affordable, and mm-hmm. I can remember those places just used to be rocking with like students and fans and alumni, and it was great. It was great atmosphere.
Yeah, no, I think the New England area, I think people don't give it enough credit. I mean, it's obviously a hockey hotbed. I don't think people give it enough credit for the emotions that they put into it. And when Hockey East first started, obviously there was, it was patented after the Big East, Dave Gavitt did, and they did the Hockey East thing, and they were trying to make the thing. And, and it brought some big rivals up. I think it took a few years. I mean, you know, we were like, I think my junior year was the first year of Hockey East. And it was fine. I mean, it was fine, but you missed playing all those teams like the St. Lawrence's and the Clarksons and the Colgates and, you know, Vermont's and like that. And it was a lot, basically it was your, you know, you're playing the BC, BU's, North, Harvard, Northwest, UNH and things like that. And it kind of took those little outskirt rivalries. They were gone. And then now it's like you play Friday and Saturday nights. Before, you used to play Tuesdays and Thursdays, or, you know, or Wednesday and a Sunday or whatever. And it was just a lot different. But now they adopted that Friday, Saturday stuff, which I don't like, but.
So, you end up in Winnipeg. Yeah. You get on the plane. So take us through that process where you kind of out of your element a little bit.
Totally out of my element. Yeah. So, Lamoriello. So the night before, we drive into Boston and we stay at the Marriott down in Faneuil Hall. And he gets me to the airport in the morning. So I got to fly. So Winnipeg has two games left in the regular season. They got to play Edmonton, the second to last game of the season. And they play Calgary, the last game of the season. And then they open up in Edmonton for the playoffs, starting the playoffs. So they're in Banff, Alberta, which is in between Calgary and Edmonton. They're there for like 4 or 5 days. You know, they had 4 or 5 days before the last couple games. So that's where I have to meet them at. So I fly into Calgary. One of the trainers picks me up. We get up there and I literally don't know a soul. I don't know a soul. I met John Ferguson, the GM, once or twice, you know, that, but I don't know anybody. So I get into my, into the hotel and nobody's around. They're all at practice. And I'm like, oh, what do I do? I mean, I think I have like $30 on me. I don't even think I know I can get exchange Canadian money. And so I'm sitting there and all of a sudden a guy walks in the door. It's Randy Carlisle. So he was my very first roommate. So we're talking, he was just asking questions about me, and I, like an idiot, I said to him, I got to tell you, Randy, I got your poster up in my room in college when he won the Norris Trophy with Pittsburgh. There was a picture of him, like in the Goal magazine, right? Him and I became really, really good friends. And the dumb person I am, I mentioned that to him. And every time I see him, he brings that up. And it's been 40 years later, you know, it's like, Jesus Christ, you know, what the hell? But anyway, I get to practice the next day.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Practice for a couple days, and then we're going to go to Edmonton for the second to last game of the season, and I don't play. I'm up in the stands, but it's just an amazing experience going to seeing them play, and it's Gretzky and all those guys. And so I don't even know if we won or lost, but after the game we got to go to Calgary, play 2 days later in Calgary, and so I'm in the lineup. And so now I'm like really nervous now. It's like, holy shit, you know, I'm this is going to happen. And do you ever see the Calgary Saddle Dome, how it's set up?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so all the benches are on one, like the benches are on one side right here and whatever. And so my very first shift, we go up there, the puck's down there, and they come down on me, and it's like a 3-on-2 or whatever it was. And they had a goal scorer by the name of Håkan Lube. I don't know if you remember the guy, Håkan Lube.
Great helmet.
Yeah. little tiny guy. But anyways, he comes down on me and he comes over the blue line and stops, like he, you know, was going to make a pass. And they blew the whistle offside. And he was probably about 3 feet away from the boards. And I just, after the whistle, go up and hit him anyway. And poof, ass over tea kettle. He's like, whatever. So now we're up against the boards and you can just see, because he's their like big goal, one of the big goal scorers. Their whole bench jumps on the ice. My very first shift, it was a bench clearing brawl. I'm like, oh my God, it was crazy. And the guys in Winnipeg going like, dude, what the hell? We're trying to get out here unscathed, you know, get ready for the playoffs. We can't, you know, whatever. But so anyways, later on in the game, they had another guy named Eddie Beers. And so we're in the second period and he's coming down and he's cutting across the middle. I come in and I'm just going to take a run at him. And I just catch his shoulder a little bit. I miss him, but I kind of catch him. And whatever, and no big deal. Next thing you know, he jumps on my back. He's like, you know, so you never fought. I mean, I think I fought once on the ice in hockey night in Boston, you know, but he's like, you don't know any of these fighting things. And he goes, you know, effing rookie, what the hell, you know, he's punching the back of the head, you know, whatever, no big deal. Anyways, the game's over. And so we're in there, and John Ferguson comes in, and he's got this big nose, and his head is huge, and he's like beat red, and he's going and he's screaming, going, this is what I want. And he grabs me and he pulls me up and he goes, this is what I want. I'm like, this is got, you know, blah blah blah. So anyway, so to make a long story short, I all of a sudden realized, all right, I'm in his head. He knows I'm not just some guy. He knows my name. I made a point, and he's going to remember what I did, you know, one of those type things. So he's not going to be afraid to call me up or do play me in any situation. And so I found my niche a little bit, like, all right, I got to be a little more physical, a little more aggressive, you know, that type thing. And I understand it. And then, so we go to Edmonton, and the very first game of the playoffs, I'm in the lineup. Now you're talking about scared to death. First round of the playoffs. I know the first 3-4 minutes I don't play. All of a sudden we get a penalty. They put me on the ice to kill a penalty. Here are the five guys that I'm playing against: Gretzky, Anderson, Curry, Messier, Coffey. Those are the five. Those are the five guys going up on the power play. And I'm going like, oh shit. And I'm looking, going like, what the hell? They dropped the puck. You know, it was kind of like a boom, 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 whatever. And I got it and I fired it down the ice and I made a beeline for the bench. My whole first shift in it was maybe like 12 seconds long. I'm going to be like hyperventilating. I'm like, this is crazy. But yeah, that was my very first, the first two times in the NHL playing. Yeah. So it was kind of crazy.
So was there a rookie like moment where it was like a come to Jesus moment, like welcome to the NHL moment? Do you have one?
I don't know if at that particular time I didn't have one, but I'll tell you what really opened your eyes, that you're playing against men now. You know, you're not in college, you know, whatever, and all these guys are, you know. Even the smallest guys, you know, a solid rock, 190 pounds, you know, and it's like, oh Jesus, you know, and good balance. And I think that's one of the things that I had going for me. I had good balance. So I wasn't afraid to get hit because I was able to stay on my feet a lot. I think the come to Jesus moments were like one of the first times I got into a big fight, and, you know, and it, yeah, it was just, oh, so here's the one that literally puts in like, what the hell am I doing here? I mean, this is the dumbest fucking thing in the world I'm doing. So the next year I'm up and down in the minors, you know, whatever. And we go into play Baltimore, the Baltimore Skipjacks. Yeah, right. Yeah. And so Winnipeg and Montreal shared a farm team in Sherbrooke. That's where we were. So like half was Winnipeg, half was Montreal. And so we had, I don't know if you remember Dom Campidelli. College. Yeah. Scotty Harlow from Boston College, Kevin Houle from Boston College, Scotty Sandelin from Duluth. We had Perry and Paul Pooley from Ohio State. Dan McFall from Michigan State. So we had a bunch of college kids on our team. And then there was the Montreal, maybe like 3 or 4 career minor league guys down there all the time and whatever. So anyways, we go into Baltimore and it's literally right out of slap shot. There was a guy named Gary Risling. I don't know if you remember Gary Risling.
Oh, yeah.
He had no teeth. He had hair every, you know, he just was like, he just snarled. He had like two bottom teeth and that was it. He's snarling at you. They had Bennett Wolf, Wally Weir. I mean, it was absolutely crazy. And we're sitting there, like Dom Campidelli and I, we're partners, and we're looking at each other going like, what the fuck we go to 4 years of school for? What, Jesus Christ. It was so scary. It was like, wow, what the hell is going on? And then it was just a shit show because they had a bunch of fighters on their team. And, and then we had, we had a couple of tough guys too, but it was like, they had like nine deep of tough guys. Yeah. And that was that one come to Jesus moment. Like, what the hell are we doing here? And every time we get on the bus or going somewhere, and Dom would be sitting next to me going like, why am I here? I can't believe I'm here. And we just laugh. We just sit. But they made their rookies sit together in a bus. You know, we just giggle the whole time to each other.
Tom, question for Tags.
Sure. Did you have anyone that kind of took you under their wing and mentored you? I know you mentioned Randy Carlyle. Was he the one, or was there somebody else?
No, I'll tell you, the best thing that happened to me was I was far away from the New England area. I was in a hockey market where, you know, everybody knew, like, where in Boston, the Boston Herald or Globe, you know, the first five pages are all, you know, whatever, like it's football season, you know, and then they get a little, even in the summertime, the first five pages of the Winnipeg Sun was hockey, 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 this, that, and everything. So you were right in this thing, and you needed to know the ropes. You figured out about yourself, but a guy like Randy Carlyle, who was my defense partner, he would just come out and say, you know, like, hey, this is not complicated. It's not rocket science. Come on, do these things, whatever it is. And as soon as I got a little full of myself, he would just like, hey, shut it down. No, 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 no. This is your job. This is what you do. And you kind of work your way through it. And then as you grow, you get a little more liberty. He kind of gives you a little more leash type thing. But off the ice stuff is where he really mentioned, you know, like you can't be going out every night. You can't, don't blow your money. Don't do all these things, you know, blah, blah, blah. Just because I've been in the league for 10, 12 years. You know, you guys can't do this. And he did it for a lot of guys too, which is really, really good. And getting traded out of there was sad because I lost a lot of really, really good friends. We had a really good team and really good guys. And that was one guy I probably missed the most once I left there, because he literally kind of give you that little solid base to lean back on.
Ed, question for Tex.
Your Tex. Tex, who is the toughest guy that you played against? Just when you saw him step out on the ice, you're just like, man, this is not going to be a fun evening. You know,
toughest or the scariest or what?
I'd say both, you know, because okay. They can be different people. So,
yeah, no. Obviously the scariest guy we ever played against was Bobby Probert. Just because he'd be like totally fine, totally fine, totally fine. And just all of a sudden, and it just like, oh shit, you know, and he was scary. He was a scary dude. We were in Winnipeg once, and he took a shot and his stick broke, and he was all like, he was mad. And he was going, and Dale Hawerchuk, which skates by him, he goes, what the, what the fuck's wrong with you? And he snapped. He just snapped. And he went after Dale, and then we're all on the ice. So we all have to go in. And luckily Paul McLean, big Mac, squared off with him, and I got Lee Norwood in the corner, and then it was just but he was the scariest dude. When you walked in, you're like, all right, where is he? What's he doing? You know, it's almost like, hey, how you doing, buddy? Just keep going. Good job. Good job. You know, whatever. There were a lot of guys. I'll tell you, the guy who every night I played against him, I knew I was going to get banged up pretty good. Stan Smeal. I don't know if you remember Stan Smeal.
Oh, yeah.
He was a little guy for the Vancouver Canucks for a lot of years. He was a tank. And I don't know. I don't know if his whole sole mission was to hit me every chance he could. Because I mean, if he hit me once, he hit me 20 times during a game and just run the crap out of me. But there was a lot of guys like that. But then all of a sudden you get the Mark Messiers of the world that you sit there. He can skate, fight, shoot, do all that stuff. And then, but I will tell you that I've learned the first few times I played against him, I wasn't whatever. But as years rolled on, playing against Mario Lemieux is absolutely, absolutely scary. Absolutely, you couldn't do anything. He did what he wanted when he wanted, if he wanted to. And then when I got to play with him, like you see him in practice, you're like, oh, what do you see in a game? You don't even scratch the surface with him. You know, that was an eye-opening experience. So, yeah.
A lot of people don't know, the younger hockey fans, how awesome the NHL was at that time with the Norris Division and the Smythe and the Adams and the Patrick. It had so many rivalries, and it to explain it in words, it just, that niche from that time, that 80s hockey was unbelievable. There'll never be another time like that. It's almost like a second golden era of hockey for me as a fan. And that Jets team was no slouch too, because they had some, well, you mentioned Dale Hawerchuk, Thomas Steen was on that team. There's a fantastic players on that team.
We just ran into the, you know, Edmonton Oilers in their, you know, in their juggernaut years. And then when that kind of faded away, Calgary had, you know, so it was like bang, 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 whatever. I've always said this about the NHL, and some people say, yeah, you're right. So I look at it, it's a regionalized cult sport. In terminology is, you have regions that are really pocketed. I mean, obviously it's better now, but back then it was New England, it was Michigan, it was Chicago, you know, whatever, in little pockets of it. And the divisions kind of mimicked those things. So the Smythe division, it was pretty much skating, all skating. You know, it was physical, but it wasn't really, really physical. You got the Norris, which was basically black and blue division. It was a 2.5 hour game took 3.5-4 hours because it was just fights, whatever. You get to the Adams division, it was a dump and chase. You know, they built the teams around dumping in, chase it, grind in the corner, throw it out in front, and you kind of scramble for a goal. Well, in the Pactor division, it was all those things combined. They had the skating, you had the fighting, you had the hitting, you know, it was everything combined in that one division. And, you know, with the Penguins, the Capitals, the Rangers, the Islanders, Philly, Jersey, it really was just an all encompassing thing. And I think it had characters too, which the league really doesn't have characters anymore. They're kind of robotic. I don't want to use the word robotic, but you know, the first six guys on the first six guys, the bottom six, you can take six guys out of the minors and plug them in, and there's no difference. They're all exactly the same. But back then, it's like, hey, you brought a guy up from the minors. It was either he was going to come up here and fight everybody that he sees, or he was going to be a goal scorer. And that was one thing that it was a little bit different, because back then, if you got brought up, you were brought up for a reason. They just didn't bring you up, you know, just to, you know, whatever. If you went on a road trip, if you had 20 guys, guy got injured, you played with 19 guys. They didn't just bring a guy up for the hell of it, you know, so it was a little bit different.
So tell us about how you ended up leaving Winnipeg and Minnesota was next, right?
Yeah. So I go on this, so the defenseman in Winnipeg was Randy Carlisle, Teppo Numminen, a guy named Frederick Olsen, Dave Ellett, Randy Carlisle, and I would be that, but then he had Sean Cronin.
Yeah.
You remember Cronin the Barbarian?
Yep.
So that was basically the sixth. And then they ended up trading for Phil Housley too. But anyways, so John Ferguson got fired. A guy named Mike Smith was the general manager, and so I was the player rep for the union. And Mike and him and I would fight. I mean, I was one of the guys who went after Allen Eagleson to put Allen Eagleson in jail. And so I was like, and right at that time they were talking about bringing the Russians over, or the Finns, and more Finns and more Swedes over. And they had this, you know, they had a transfer fee of $200,000 they had to pay to whatever team they were from to come over here, then pay the salary. And I used to argue with Mike Smith all the time about it. So why are you spending all that money? I mean, a lot of these guys come over and they're not the superstar. If they're a superstar, great. But if they're just an average guy, what the, you know, we used to argue that all the time. about Russians coming over. And so I actually
get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast tennis ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
That year, I had the very first Russian that came over was with the Winnipeg Jets, and his name was Sergei Harin. And in training camp, Mike Smith, to bust my balls, made me room with him. You know, just he literally, I got my room assignment. I'm like, look at him, and he's in the corner, like snickering, going, you know, one of those type things. But anyways, so he pulls me in. He says, "We're going to trade you." You know, I said, "All right, Mike, listen, I don't want to stay in Canada." I said, if you want me to be the seventh defenseman here, I'll stay here and be the seventh defenseman. I don't want to go anywhere else in Canada, but if you can, move me to the States." He said, "Okay." So they're in the exhibition season, and so obviously they, you know, don't come to the game, or, you know, whatever it is a game that night. And I get a phone call, and it says, he says, "Hey, we traded you to Minnesota." And it's like, "Oh, great. Bobby Clark's going to call you." And I said, "Okay." And so we had just, we just had I have two sets of twins. So my first set of twins, I have at the time he was a 2-year-old, and then I have a set of twins. And so we're trying to figure all this stuff out. And they said, "All right, we'll give you a few days, get your stuff together, and then come down." I said, "Okay." So I get down there, and it was, I thought it'd be a really good experience going down there and playing. I knew some of the guys, but it was just miserable. It was from Bobby Clark to Bob Gainey to Doug Jarvis to Andy Murray, who was the coach. They didn't want you to laugh. They didn't want you to joke around. It was miserable going to the rink, and it was just a horrible, horrible. To the time I got traded, I think we won maybe six games, and you know, it was bad. And then just one day out of the blue, we're playing that night. It was December 13th of 1990. And, the phone rings. I just got home. I'm going to have something to eat. And it was Bobby Clark. And he says, and I'll tell you exactly. Have you ever interviewed Bobby?
No, I'd love to, but.
So I pick it up. He goes, "Peter, it's Bobby Clark. Yeah, we traded you. Craig Patrick from Pittsburgh is going to call you." That was it. That was like, what the? And so the only reason why, like he said, as soon as he said Craig Patrick, I was like, oh, because a year before, the 88 Olympics were in Calgary, right? And so they wanted to test all the venues. So Team USA put a team together, and Craig was the coach of it. And I was on the team. It was one of those, over Christmas for the guys in the minors, like Brett Hull was on the team. Dom Campidelli was on the team. We had a lot of guys. And anyways, so Craig calls. He goes, "Hey, Pete, how you doing? Oh, my God. I haven't talked to you in a year now? Jesus, blah, 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 blah." We're going out. He's talking about, remember the time in Calgary? We're going, and we're having it was a great old conversation. He goes, oh, shit. By the way, you got an hour and a half to get to the plane. You got to play tonight. He goes, "All right, we'll talk to you when you get in. Bye." Boom, hangs the phone up. I said, I grab a duffel bag, threw as much stuff as I can in the duffel bag. I book it to the airport. Larry Murphy got traded with me at the time. And so we literally pull up at the same time. And the trainer for the North Stars showed up. We were right around the same time with our gear and blah, blah, blah. We get on the plane. We get into Pittsburgh. And the assistant coach, Rick Patterson, was right there. And he picked, you know, whatever. And so now it's like 4 o'clock. And now we got rush hour. You've been to Pittsburgh? You having to go through the tunnels?
No.
It's just and so police escort. It's like we're going down the parkway. There's like parting of the Red Sea. The cops are leading us. We're flying behind them. We get to the rink, and I knew a lot of guys on the team, like the Kevin Stevens, Johnny Cullen. They're all from either from Boston or played in Boston. Randy Gillen played in Winnipeg with me. Andrew McBain was there. Jim Kite was there. So I knew a lot of the guys. So it was actually kind of cool walking in there. And then Rick Patterson, hey, Bob Johnson wants to talk to you. And I said, oh, so Badger Bob, all right, go in the bed. He goes, hey, Pete, how you doing? Oh, my, blah, blah. It's a great day for hockey, you know, and he's like the most upbeat person you've ever met. I'm like, whatever. He goes, hey, can you play the right side with Paul Coffey? And I go, yeah. He goes, all right, we'll see you out there. I was like, all right, great. So I'm like, oh, my God. Like, now I'm jumping. Like, oh, my God, now I got to play with Paul Coffey. So I was like, shit. So anyways, we get to we get into the game and whatever it is. And so Paul Coffey, Mario, Kevin, Mark Greky, and you've seen superstitious teams before. And, you know, like you watch at a certain time on a clock, somebody does something and somebody yells something at another time. I didn't know any of those things that they do. So we're on the ice and I grab a puck and they're going, Jesus, what the hell are you doing? They're screaming. I'm like, so I didn't do anything for the first 10 minutes of the warm-up. I didn't know what to do. I just had to watch and see and follow and follow and follow. Yeah. And then, get on the ice and Paul Coffey said, hey, you want to get some points or, you know, cause come up the ice. We'll just, I said, I'm good where I am. I'll play defense and whatever it is. And he goes, all right, whatever. Just remember, there's no money in defense. And you know, so he was never where he was supposed to be. And he was gone somewhere doing something. And I was like, all right, we'll figure it out. But yeah, it was a great atmosphere. It was just like the same exact atmosphere in Winnipeg was there. A bunch of fun guys. We laughed, we joked. We didn't take it too seriously unless we had to type thing. And it just made. And then plus you have Bob Johnson, who never, ever raised his voice, never yelled. I mean, if he had something negative to say, he said it, but if I did something positive right after it, I mean, it was never had a coach like that in my life at all. And it was just so uplifting. Yeah.
Before we get too far into the two Stanley Cup years with back to back, I'll have these two guys ask you a round of questions. Thomas.
Yeah. Did your role change? Did you have the same role with Pittsburgh as you did with Winnipeg and Minnesota, or did you find it changed at all?
I think, you know, I say this to when my kids were little and young kids would ask me questions. I always said, you know, find your niche, exploit the niche. And then once you get all that, you can expand from there. And when I was in Winnipeg, I thought, well, I'm going to be a stay-at-home defenseman. I missed the all rookie team by 1 point. My rookie year, I had 6 goals, 19 assists, whatever it was as a rookie. I had 190 minutes in penalties. And, you know, that was my thing. And I got to Pittsburgh and it was kind of the same way. I just, you know, I had a fight when I had to fight. If Paul Coffey or Mario, I mean, it was better for me to get punched in the face and those guys to get punched in the face. You know, that was the niche role that I assumed. But it changed a little bit as I got older with the talented teams we had. I didn't have to worry about any of that. So I became more of a defensive defenseman. I didn't really care about any assist. And I cared more about the plus minus parts of the game. And that's what I really concentrated on. So 1 year, I think I was plus 26 and Paul Coffey, my defense partner, was like minus 19 or whatever it was. So it was like a little bit of a, so, I mean, that's what I, so my contract, I structured my contracts of the plus minuses of the work, you know, and if we made the playoffs, first round, second round, third rounds and things like that, that's the way I structured my, you know, they, if I won the MVP, they my first contract, if I won the MVP, I'm like, this crap. Yeah. It was a waste of a tree to put that on there.
Ed, question for Tags.
Sure. As your career went along, like, how did you prepare for the season when you first were right out of college and how you guys trained in college and as you kind of progressed? A lot of guys that we've talked to, you know, as their careers progressed, they kind of changed how they trained. Also, exercise science kind of became a little bit more into the game as the 80s and the early 90s came into play.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I laugh at some of these guys that I get a pulled muscle and, you know, whatever it is, like pulled muscle. It was so funny. Nobody had pulled muscles when we played, you know, either blew your knee out or that or something, you broke a bone. You didn't pull a muscle, you know. But these guys train 12 months out of the year now. Maybe they take a few weeks off here and there, but they train all the time. And it's funny because you worked out in the summer, you did your thing, you know, you were aerobically based athletes, but we have anaerobic capabilities, which is we can go those short spurts and then we can recover very quickly because we've got that aerobic, you know, whatever. And that's why we trained. You know, you lift your weights, you go for your long runs, you do your sprints on your bike, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's how we train to do our thing. And basically training camp was to get into shape. You, like a lot of guys, they put their skates away at the end of the year. They didn't touch them. Maybe like 3 weeks ago, 3 weeks before camp, they put their skates on. And that's basically what it was. We didn't do this all, you know, go to these camps in the summertime or anything like that. And you got into shape as you went. And it's funny is that if you talk to any of the guys from that era in training camp, you'll see the rookies, right? They're like full of piss and vinegar, right? They're up here and they're and all the veterans are down here. And as training camp goes, you can see, you know, and they realize what it takes to get to the very first game where all the rookies and the first couple of years, they kind of fall off to the side. So we kind of had that mindset of, all right, we're in shape. We're not in game shape, but we have, you know, 3 weeks to getting in shape. And that's what we did. But now with the science and the diets and the chefs they have, and so one of my sons is the head equipment manager for the Penguins now. And so they, you know, so I was just in Pittsburgh and our grandson is 3 years old, skates, you know, whatever. So we're down watching him and the chef's out there talking, hey, you know, we're going to make this for him this morning. And, you know, lunch, we're going to do this and dinner. We're going to do what? It's like you stop and get some French fries at the McDonald's and cook the hamburger at home. That's what we used to do, you know? Yeah, it's way different now. So, but I mean, it changed that we were more, we were very into riding bikes. As my career got going, we lift and maintain, but we rode before the game, before practices, we rode after practices, we warmed up before games, we rode hard after games to get the lactic acid out. So those little things creeped into our nomenclature as we got older. And right after I left, you know, in the, you know, 97, 98, they really started getting into that sports science stuff, which is, you know, the, you know, before it was nobody wanted to do plyometrics. You know, it was like, you know, I forgot who it was. Somebody in Buffalo was doing plyometrics, blew his knee out for the season, gone for the season. And then like pretty much every NHL team said, all right, nobody's doing plyometrics. And now what does everybody do? They're all doing plyometrics. Yeah. So who knows?
So Tags, I got to ask you, those two Stanley Cups, I'm going to jump around with this one, but how sweet was it beating Minnesota after the story you told me?
Oh, it was unbelievable. The old Met Center, when I was there, they were getting maybe like 8,000, 7,000 people a game. And the guy who bought them, Norm Green, he started doing all these giveaways, you know, like giving like $100,000 away at game time, you know, like TVs and this and, you know, and a shot at, you know, $1,000 here and this and whatever. And he was giving like all this stuff and they're pumping music in to make it loud. And so they struggled all the way until probably like the trade deadline. And then they, all of a sudden they snuck in and they played really well and they worked away and they got into the finals. And so we were there and it's too bad because there were some really nice guys in the team. There were really good guys on the team. And after we won, as we're shaking hands, they all say, you know, we're happy for you. But you know, they're sad for themselves, but they're happy for you because you get out of here because that's they were miserable, absolutely miserable there. We had a lot of guys when I played at Providence. We had a lot of guys from Minnesota on our team. And so I was able to get them a lot of tickets. So they were all at the game and they were able to come down to the locker room with us afterwards and party with us and do all that stuff. But yeah, it was a lot of fun beating them. And it's more so the management of them.
So first year Penguins Stanley Cup, yep. Second year Penguins Stanley Cup, which team was better? You got Mark Recchi on the first one, Rick Tocchet on the second one, which team's better?
The 93 team, but we lost that team. But,
right.
The 92 team had more talent on it. The 91 team had I think we all just got caught up in that snowball that, you know, so Larry Murphy and I get there in December and we still kind of struggled a little bit. And then they made the trade for Ronnie Francis and Ulf Samuelson and Grant Jennings. And they brought in Scotty Young. I know you remember Scott yep. Young. Yep. He was there. And it was just, we got kind of caught up in that snowball and we actually really didn't know what was happening. It's Brian Trotche and Joey Mullen. We had some really, Yuri Herdina. We had some really veteran guys. And I remember Brian Trotche, who's, you ever get him on the, you got it because he's absolutely hysterical. Oh, he's so much fun. But he would just kind of like, hey, you know, this is going to happen. He's walking you through the process. But it happened so quick. Like literally we went from the first round also in the finals, we win it. And it was like, you really couldn't even enjoy it. You enjoyed it like 2 weeks later going like, oh my God, you know, but it was happened so fast. It seemed so fast, you know, whatever. And the second year, all right, we got a little, we could understand it a little bit better. We kind of know what's going on and we were able to savor it a little bit more. But we had just as much talent, if not more. We lost Paul Coffey, and we lost Rex, but we still had a pretty good core of guys, and obviously we had Yager, who was, you know, in his second year, which is like ridiculous, you know, whatever. And they got Mario doing what he does, and you know, and our quiet guys like
get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Like Joey Mullen, Trotz, bat in the first year we had, you know, I remember Barry Peterson, you know, he was one of our key face-off guys, you know, just role players that kind of did all these things. And in our second year, we had more guys and actually we had some injuries and we had a call up a line from, our minor league team in Cleveland. They're our fourth line guy, Mike Needham, Jock Callender and Dave Mikowski, and they played a big role. They scored some huge goals for us in that cup run. But we were able to savor it a little bit more. And then the next year, I got picked up in expansion by Tampa Bay. So I call it my 4 month sabbatical. I went down there for 4 months and then got traded back to Pittsburgh. So, and then that was probably our best team in 93. We were rolling. I mean, if somebody within like two or three goals in a game with us, we're like, you know, we played like crap, you know, that type of thing. That's how good we were.
It was those pesky Islanders that you got you.
David Volek.
I remember.
Yeah, 100 shots. Tom Barrasso knocks, you know, grabs it and throws it. You know, it's fine. Yeah, he just caught him, but it's too bad.
Tom, question for Tex.
Yeah, is there a coach, whether it be college or the NHL, that you think that you can credit with helping your career out more than others?
Lou Lamoriello gave me structure. Like repetition, you know, like, and thinking of what's going to happen before it happens. And I had a pretty good sense of it, but he really drilled it home of if you have to think you're lost type thing, it's like, you just got to do it. I mean, your mind just can't wander and every time if something happens, three more things possibly could happen. So you're going to prepare for that. But I remember, so just real quick, my baseball career and growing up playing like Colt League and Stan Musial and all that stuff. I had a baseball case, two of them, Brian Alexson and Bill Robinson. And we like every day we're practicing drilling, or if we didn't have games, we were drilling. And it was like situational stuff. You know, one out, did it, and made you think in just split second time. So I had that in my head. Lou Lamoriello kind of nailed it home. And then when I turned pro, believe it or not, there's not a lot of coaches that work on technique they expect you to already know that, and they kind of just throw you out there, and we're just going to do it this way, you know, that type thing. And then, but when I got to Pittsburgh with Bob Johnson, he actually did a lot of that, the technique stuff of the, you know, turning and spinning and blah, 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 and not turning it back to plays and defensive coverage and all that kind of stuff. And he kind of did all that, but he did it in a very subtle way. But he was probably the one that really kind of, plus it opened up your mind, because like I said, he never yelled. We could lose 6-1, and literally we were like, oh, he's going to lose it. And no, doesn't. All right. We had a couple, you know, and we had a couple bad things, but look at all the good stuff we did. You know, look at the save, you know, Tommy made or Frankie made, or, you know, look at the pass he came out of the zone with. And it was like, huh, all right. Same thing. All of a sudden you go again, and all of a sudden the same thing. It's like, great day for hockey. Blah, blah, blah. No matter what happened, great day for hockey. Yeah, if you see a Western, let's go see the Clint movie, the Clint Eastwood movie on tonight. Ah, the hockey, you know. Ah. And you actually wanted to go to the rink. And so when you were doing those drills, it didn't seem like you were working. You know, you were excited to be there. It was a lot of fun, you know. And so when he was doing those specific drills, it wasn't like doing them. You did them because you had fun doing them, and he kind of just picked the pace up there. Yeah. So he was probably the one that really kind of made you like hockey again, made you like the sport.
Ed, question for Tags.
Well, I'd like to say, take us through what it felt like after all the years of hockey to be handed the Stanley Cup, you know, and how'd that feel? Like, just, you know, after all the journey, all the time at the rink, all the, you know, the bus rides and the plane rides and everything.
Get from Framingham.
Yeah, no, and you just said from Framingham. So back then, you know, the guy with the white gloves goes around with the cup?
Yeah.
Well, back then he wasn't around. There was nobody. So we win it. I just go down the rink to, you know, BS with the trainers or whatever it is. And I walk into the office and the cup's there. And I go, you know, can I take that? Yeah. Take it. Here we go. And pop it in the car, driving down the parkway. People, whatever. I call other guys. We find the dingiest, dumpiest bar, and we go. And within like a half hour, there's 1,000 people waiting to get in. And so we let the guy make some money. We take it to another bar and do all these things. But anyways, so one day I call. I want to do something in Framingham, right? And so I want to bring the cup to Framingham. I want to raise money for the youth hockey program. So I called the Hockey Hall of Fame and I said, you know, this is what I want to do. They said, yeah, all right. When do you want it? I said, well, when can I have it? They go, how about July, you know, 20th to the 24th? I'm like, all right. So I'll send you, here's my credit card. Just send it down. I said, no, don't worry about it. Just gave me the address to go to in the cargo department of Logan Airport. So my buddy drive in there and they're going like, is that what it is? It says Stanley Cup on the trunk. And it's like, yeah. So I get it out there, taking pictures of it. I take it back to my hometown. Take it to the hospital, you know, and believe it or not, there was somebody from Pittsburgh who had a baby. They're from Maine, going back to Pittsburgh, had a baby in my hometown, and the baby was I got a picture of him in the cup and all that kind of stuff. But anyways, but it was like I was like the first person to take it home. When now they do it all the time, yeah. But I was like the first person to take it to my hometown. If you had it in Pittsburgh, everybody took it in Pittsburgh. They just said, you know, I had a party at their house or whatever it is. But I was the first one. Yeah, I'm going to take it to my hometown. So I had it for like 4 days in my hometown, just nice. Goofing around with it. Yeah, they just patched it up and sent it back again. But lifting a cup, you know, the first thing happened to me when I lifted it, I thought about the guys that I played with that haven't gotten it. The Randy Carlisle's of the world, the Dale Hawerchuk's, the Thomas Steen's of the world, who were, I mean, those Thomas Steen is probably the most underrated hockey player you've ever met in your life. I mean, I ever heard of. Dale Hawerchuk was just a superstar, an all-around great guy. Randy Carlisle, with all his stuff he did, and that was like the first thing that hit me. It was like, oh my god, I can't believe I did this, and they've been part of hockey lore for way longer than I have, and the stuff they did, and. Yeah, it was kind of, but you know, about 2 weeks later is when it really hit you that, oh my God, you're able to settle down a little bit, and you know, you get the kid, your kids are there, and they, you know, you get pitches with them in the cup and whatever. And then it was like, oh shit, this is actually for real. I mean, and then it just, I mean, any city lights up, and so you can go anywhere in Pittsburgh for next couple of years without somebody, oh my God, this, you know, we got, you know, come drinking with us, or, you know, let's go golf and we'll go do this, whatever it is. And it was really hard to find time to just like to chill out and relax. But yeah, it was fun though. It was, my liver took a beating.
So funny story. We had Bill Ranford on, and he won the year before you did. Yeah. And he said that, oh, we weren't allowed to do any of that stuff. Nobody did that. Well, I got news for you, Bill. The year after, tag started, the whole thing.
So I, shoot, I don't have the, it's not, so, you know, the lore of the Stanley Cup and all the goofy shit that's happened with it.
Oh, yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. So it was a Sunday night because no place was open. And we're like, where can we go? So we all go back to Mario's house in Mount Lebanon. And I think they knew somebody who had, who owned a bar. They went and got beer. They got us a bunch of booze and beer and stuff like that. We're having a party. And next thing, like, we're all annihilated. And the cup's in the bottom of the pool. It was like if you, it's like 45, 50, you know, it's, but it's awkward, you know? And so it's, even when it's, like not filled with water, it's kind of heavy, kind of goofy. And my wife at the time, we're the only camera, but there was, we couldn't hold our breath long enough to get down and go down and get it because we were too drunk. So two guys had to dive down and hold their breath for as long and kind of roll it to, you know, go up the little thing. And then two guys would come down and the two guys would come down and, you know, just, and finally get it. And we get it up and we get empty it out and whatever it was. And it was kind of broken. The top was broken up and our they didn't want to have a parade for us that first year, because when the Steelers won it a few years early, like in the late 70s, they had so many people, they couldn't control the crowd, and they said they had 100,000 people it was both. It was just, they had it like glued on with super glue just to, so it wouldn't fall off. But yeah.
So, Tags, you, how did you know when your career was starting to wind down? The easiest way to put it.
Your body. I mean, I've had a lot of surgeries. I mean, I was injured. I had the way I played. I mean, I took hits, gave hits. You know, you just see it. I mean, you knew it. I mean, you'd like to play as long as you can, and then, you know, finally, it's. I was against the boards, and a guy was literally 3 feet from me standing still and came in and just kind of pushed me against the boards, and my hip popped, and that was the end of that. So, but I think you kind of knew it. I mean, when I started playing, so when I turned pro in 85, the lifespan of a hockey player was like 5 years, 6 years tops. And then expansion came and kind of pushed that to 8 years. And so they kind of 8 years, 9 years, like what I made it 12 years. Now I guess went back down because of the salary cap. You know, the superstars are going to keep playing, the bottom guys and the middle guys get taken out now. So I think it's probably back down to like 7 or 8 years now. But yeah, I who would have thought I would play 12 years? I mean, so when a couple of cups, had some great experiences. And yeah, but I think you kind of know you're a little bit slower than you think you are. And I mean, maybe if this technology and this training, you know, after the fact was around, could have lasted a few little longer. But yeah, you know, but you know, the worst part is the guys who chase it and chase it and chase it. And all of a sudden, I mean, I was done at age, what, 33, 34. So I was able to have another life. And a lot of guys who chase, are the ones who get into trouble, that now they got to play catch up to, now when they try to get a job, they got to play with the compete against a 22, 23 year old, and you're 44, 45, whatever it is. And you kind of get into that tailspin of a lifestyle and see a lot of guys, you know, get into that. And I was, as soon as I get out, got a job. I did the broadcast. I was able to do the broadcast, but I was able after that, do the, get a job and do my thing and whatever, and make a pretty good life of it. So I can't complain.
So as we start kind of winding down, as we hit that hour mark ish, I'm going to have the guys ask like one more round of questions. Tom, question for Tags.
Sure. How'd you get into broadcasting? Was that something you wanted to do, or is it just,
I had the, I think all athletes have that mentality that they want to stay in the sport for long as possible, whatever, whether it's, you know, playing, coaching or whatever. They called me and said, listen, would you be interested in trying out to be a broadcaster? And I said, yeah, you know, so, it was the first part was radio, doing the radio with a guy named Matt McConnell. There was a couple guys who were looking at the job as well. But I was the only guy. I mean, I sat there and made some notes. I mean, and I kind of went on the airplane and, you know, I was talking to Matt about him, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, he says, you're the only one that came with notes like that looked things up. Everybody just thought they were going to wing it and, you know, and just kind of whatever it was. And so I did it for like 4 or 5 years and then, get out into private business. And, yeah, you know, I don't know if I want to stay in that life. I mean, obviously some guys make a really good living at it, but if I wanted to stay in that life, I would have to pick up and move a lot. And I had five kids, two sets of twins, and I was not going to pick, you know, like me leave and them by them at home or pick them up and keep moving and moving and moving them. And I just said, you know, I'm not doing that to them. You know, they moved enough when they were babies. I'm not going to do this now. They got a good group of people and they were friends with. And I think I made that conscious effort. I'll cut ties and do my thing. And I'll get involved in hockey somewhere, you know, like coaching little kids or doing some camps and stuff like that, but nothing. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I loved it, but I'm glad I got out of it. My body, you know, I was able to heal instead of, you know, doing all that kind of stuff. So yeah, a little different.
Ed, question for Tags as we wrap up.
You touched on playing with Yager. You touched on playing with Mario.